You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, March 11th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein will be joining us a little bit later, but he will show up. So in the meantime, I have a This Day in Science and Skepticism. March 11th, 1997. You guys remember what happened on that date?
97.
March. They invented those high-rise shoes that have fish in them. You know, the ones with the plexiglass.
That was like the 70s, dude.
97, Jay.
Oh, 97.
97 was more like inventing Matchbox 20 or something.
They invented dirty sweaters.
That is the day that Gene Roddenberry's ashes were launched into space.
Oh.
Oh, and that.
It was that long ago?
Yeah, right?
Oh, my God. 97.
Gene Roddenberry. You may be thinking, remember that Scotty's was a much more recent event.
Oh, yeah, maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. Well, there's a very quick Large Hadron Collider update. We've been following this story, so just want to keep you updated. The scientists who are running the LHC have announced that at the end of 2011, they are going to shut down the LHC for a year to do maintenance. Until then, they're going to run it at half power, which they think is working fine. But they don't want to get it up to full power because they're afraid that it's not going to hold together, that the connections that between the magnets may not be strong enough.
Proof that the LHC is reaching back in time to stop itself.
Yeah, there you go.
Not to be a dick, man. Wouldn't they have kind of thought that out ahead of time?
In their defense, he said, listen, this is something that you build once. You design it and you build it once. It's a completely unique, you know, engineering feat, mm-hmm. and therefore there's no experience for this kind of thing.
Yeah, they were saying that the LHC is its own prototype, and they're pushing technologies towards their limit. So it's hard.
But
to
is
totally
that really true? Because there are
it.
Plenty of there are plenty of other particle accelerators that have come before it.
True,
but
not,
this one goes to 11.
They're not as powerful, they're not as large. But I mean, it's not like this was invented out of whole cloth.
That's true. But again, remember, this is already more powerful than any other collider. And they want to go more powerful still. It's the pushing of those limits that's really straining the engineering to its limits. And I think it's a reasonable precaution. Rather than waiting for it to break down, they'll say, before we go up to full, let's reinforce it and make sure it's not going to break down.
Well, that makes sense. I shouldn't have been so quick to judge. I mean, the cost of this machine, it's huge. The complexity, the amount of different types of technology they're you know, stringing together in there. Yeah, absolutely. I could totally see that.
And it's easy to focus on the problems that they've encountered, but there's also hundreds or thousands of other areas that are just going swimmingly well, right? They've just gone incredibly well, but you don't really hear about those as much as you know these silly little things that go wrong. It's still, though, I am extremely disappointed. another 14-month delay. Oh, my God.
Right, but it's not till the end of 2011. We still got a year and a half at half power.
Know. The thing that sucks is, you know, it looks like anytime they want to make an upgrade or they want to tweak something, they've got to shut this thing down.
Yeah.
You know, completely take huge components apart, let it cool off, you know, put a fan on it.
They lose a whole season anytime they have to shut it off to do anything. Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, Jenny McCarthy is at it again.
Oh, God.
Did she ever stop?
Yeah, that's true. She never stopped. She's still at it.
She
wrote an article in, guess where?
The Huffington Post.
The Huff Post.
Oh, God, of course.
Where else? The Huffington Post have to complete, you know, their repertoire of anti-vax loons who have written for them. She wrote an article called Who's Afraid of the Truth About Autism? Who's Afraid of the Truth? And she essentially just strings together a whole list of claims that she's made before. She's clearly not listening to the other side or evolving her claims at all. But the core of her claim this time is that mothers are correct and that historically scientists and science gets it wrong every time and they have to be corrected by the mothers who just instinctively know what the truth is. Which
As Orek put so well in his post, and I loved what he wrote about her, he put it, you know, she's so busy that she doesn't have time because she's helping people.
Yeah.
That's why she can't, you know, sit down and really digest all the information, because she's just so booked helping other people, helping other mothers.
You're right. That's that we hear from snake oil salesmen and cranks all the time. I'm too busy helping people to study what I'm doing, to, you know, to do the science, to worry about, you know, efficacy trials or whatever. Whatever it is you're accusing them of, I'm too busy curing people.
And think about how ridiculous that claim is. Okay, so why don't you take 3 hours one afternoon and do some reading? That's all we're asking.
So she, for example, repeats the statement, autism's 60-fold rise in 30 years matches a tripling of the U.S. vaccine schedule. You know, actually, it doesn't. If you look at different countries at different times, there really is no consistent relationship between the rate of autism and the vaccine schedule. The vaccine schedule is rising and falling at different times in different places. But the autism diagnoses consistently correlate with expanding the diagnosis, increasing surveillance because of services.
Yeah. Steve, you know? I agree. Just yesterday, I found out that the daughter of a friend was diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum. And when I heard that, I was shocked, because this girl, she seemed fine to me, you know, maybe a little, you know, a little on the odd side, just a tad. I mean, not a big deal, but from what I heard, after the extensive testing, she's extremely bright, very bright girl. But her reactions to social situations, I guess they quizzed her, they tested her on her reactions to social situations, and she was consistently kind of just not aware of what was happening or what to do to a significant degree. So they diagnosed her, therefore, somewhere on the spectrum. And my response to that was, she's being diagnosed with that? I mean, what a wide net. I mean, that's got to be part of the reason. This net is so much wider than it used to be.
Yeah, 20 or 30 years ago, she never would have been diagnosed.
Never.
Yeah. I mean, that's an anecdote that demonstrates what's actually been confirmed experimentally. Yes. When you look at, I mean, that's just a story to put a face to it, but that actually has been confirmed over and over again experimentally and observationally. When you look at how the diagnoses are being made, they're absolutely casting a wider net, and that explains it. So, I mean, all the other things she said we've debunked previously. It really was just her, you know, just stringing together the rant. She's defending Andrew Wakefield without really knowing any of the facts behind the case.
Way you can defend Wakefield if you know any of the facts behind the case. Yeah. I mean, the guy is such an incredible douchebag. He's been discredited so thoroughly that it baffles me. I was actually pretty sure that they would abandon him after the, you know, the recent ruling, but amazingly, they've decided to stick with it.
She says that Wakefield is vilified for saying that children with autism are suffering from bowel disease, which has been replicated many times. That's wrong. It hasn't been replicated. It's only been replicated by anti-vaccine researchers and the broader scientific community, including Maddie Hornig, for example, repeated exactly Wakefield's study and found that there was zero association with bowel disease. That finding has not been replicated. The science has proven that to be wrong. So she is just repeating the canards and the standard talking points over and over again, immune from the evidence, absolutely immune. But more amusing to me than Jenny McCarthy's rant in the HuffPo, Rebecca, was an article you wrote about dogs with autism.
Yeah, I think that this is exactly what the autism or the, you know, the anti-vaccine community deserves, because I feel like often we're trying to point out the obvious to the anti-vaxxers, and you always have to be nice about it, because in the end, you know, forget about Jenny McCarthy. You're talking to parents who are worried about their children and they're just ignorant of the science. But finally we get the inevitable, I guess, next milestone in the anti-vax community, which is pet anti-vax people. And so the Daily Mail here, once again, I know we've mentioned the Daily Mail in the past for their just terrible, terrible reporting here in England, but here they go again. They recently had an article all about a woman named Catherine O'Driscoll, who is the head of an organization supposedly to help dogs. And she claims that vaccinations, too many vaccinations, are causing autism in puppies. And she specifically says, you know, we are not anti-vaccination. What we're saying is that currently they're receiving far too many. Where have we heard that before?
Yeah.
Maybe from Jenny McCarthy and them. You can basically just take everything that Jenny McCarthy has ever said and cross out kids and replace puppies, and you've got this kook.
I'm curious, though, how do you diagnose autism in puppies?
Well, they include a sample case known as Charlie the Autistic Spaniel. Someone on Twitter suggested that Charlie the Autistic Spaniel would make a great kids cartoon, so somebody out there should get on that. But Charlie the Autistic Spaniel apparently bit his owner on the face and her husband on the hand with no provocation.
Animals
grew
don't
up,
do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up with Cocker Spaniels and I got bit all the time. So they must have, also been autistic. They had too many vaccinations. And it's not just dogs that O'Driscoll's concerned about. It's also bunnies and kittens. I mean, can you guys imagine an autistic cat, a cat that doesn't come when you call it by name and that, you know, just stares off into space or gets, you know, freaks
aloof
out at the slightest provocation? Yeah. it's terrible.
So,
it's
Rebecca,
really,
under these standards, all domesticated animals are autistic?
Yes, pretty much. Yeah, it's really...
Except gerbils.
No, I don't know. Have you ever owned a gerbil? I had a hamster once, and, I mean, it was more antisocial than autistic, I think. But
yeah, gerbils are just assholes.
Could you imagine some total... You know, I'm so tweaked and frustrated with this anti-vax BS. Some jackass is sitting around their house looking at their puppy. The puppy does something that upset them, and they come up with autism.
Yeah, and as a few skeptic commenters rightfully pointed out, I mean, it's funny because it's so completely absurd. Like, this isn't the sort of thing, like, with the regular anti-vax crowd, we feel that even though things have been debunked multiple times, we still need to provide information to people who might be hearing it for the first time. But
yeah,
the idea that dogs get autism, to me, is just so ridiculous that you can just say, look at this crazy person, and people will just nod their head and say, yes, that's absurd. But there is something very sad to the idea of people who are foregoing vaccinations in their pets, because these vaccinations do actually serve a purpose. And if you've ever seen an animal with rabies, you know that it's very serious. And if you've ever seen a person with rabies, you know, it's incredibly serious because it's always going to be deadly, unless they get vaccinated. Which makes me wonder, you know, because the rabies virus, you know, you get vaccinated after you're bit by an animal, and you have a certain number of days as the rabies virus, you know, gets going in your system. You have a few days to get vaccinated before it kills you. But if you don't get vaccinated in time, then it will definitely kill you. There's no cure. So it makes me wonder, I mean, if Jenny McCarthy was bitten by a rabid raccoon, I wonder, would she get a vaccination, or would she just let it kill her? Because, I mean, do I chance become autistic or let Big Pharma poison me, or do I die of rabies?
But to put this story in a complete context, we have to recognize that it is extremely challenging to develop an animal model of a psychiatric or mental disorder. We are only now developing animal models of autism for research, mainly in mice. Although I did read an article where they are trying to develop a model in dogs by coincidence. However, in each of these cases, they are giving the animals a genetic mutation that is known to correlate with autism. So the very animal models that we have support the genetic theory or hypothesis of autism, not an environmental cause. And then behaviorally, they have to look statistically at subtle behaviors like social interactions. It's not the kind of thing you're going to be able to casually observe in your pet.
Well, you could always just get a pet psychic.
Yeah, you could always get the pet psychic. That's true.
you know, what right do they have to take such incredible liberties with information or just come up with conclusions that are based on nothing? Like, just because they're either not educated or they're not applying their brain whatsoever when it comes to this particular topic doesn't give them a pass in any way.
Well,
it's still
dangerous. I must say, yeah, they don't get a pass, but this is, Jay, we are now in the age where everyone's their own expert. Right, that's the democratization. This is the dark underbelly of the internet, of the democratization of information. Everyone's their own expert now. We've completely devalued expertise to the point that anyone thinks that they could come up with scientific hypotheses and start spreading them around and raising money, starting organizations. And
well, I think
their
that
views
sucks.
Should be valid.
I think it sucks. I think people. You're right. They, you know, they read things, and you know they're not vetting the information that they're reading. You know, the stuff goes right in, and you know there's no filter in place, and that's dangerous. That's very dangerous.
Yeah, but the filter should be run it by somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. You know, just acknowledge that there's a gulf between your lack of expertise and people who have spent years or decades studying every in and out of a subject. Just run it by an expert to see if it's even remotely reasonable, rather than just assuming that you can come up with some half-baked idea and overturn areas of science, you know?
It's all the internet's fault.
Yeah. Well, let's go on. Bob, you're going to tell us about see-through stuff that physicists have been able to make.
This time, Steve, I'm going to start first with a slightly sensationalistic title, just to draw some people in, okay?
Yep.
Scientists developed method to see through solid objects like Superman. Did you guys hear about that? Well, actually, another way to put it is researchers in Paris create a transmission matrix to see through an opaque layer of zinc oxide, 80,000th of a millimeter thick. That's another way to look at it. But actually, the coolness of this development lies somewhere between those two titles that I just read. The research itself was done at ESPCI, which is the City of Paris Industrial Physics and Chemistry Higher Educational Institution. They devised a way to see through an opaque material. The thing is, though, you need to know a lot about the material first and the way that it affects and scatters light that's trying to go through it. So you just can't, you know, just aim this thing at something and see through it. Further in the future, you really got to – the whole idea is that you need to know a lot about the material. So in the experiment that these guys did, it was really interesting. They shined a green laser beam at a layer of zinc oxide, really thin, like only 80,000th of a millimeter thick. So this is like really thin stuff, you know. It's not, you know, not even a piece of paper or something real tiny. This is incredibly, incredibly thin layer. And you guys remember zinc oxide? Remember, it's used in white paint and sunscreens. Remember years ago, you'd see lots of lifeguards with the zinc oxide in their nose. I don't know. You don't really see it that much now anymore with the really powerful sunscreens. But
I thought that was just sunscreen.
Yeah, but you don't really – it was like old-fashioned sunscreen. I mean, they use just pure zinc oxide. Now the sunscreens are more sophisticated. You don't need to look goofy with a white nose, right? You just put on SPF 70 and you're good to go. So what they did was they examined this light. They shined this laser light onto the zinc oxide, and then they have to examine exactly how this light kind of changed as it interacted with the material. They don't go into detail how that was done. I'm not sure exactly how you would do that, but they were able to construct from this information. They create this numerical model that describes the interaction in detail. So it's called a transmission matrix. And if you saw this matrix of numbers for light, say going through pure water, it would just be a few numbers, right? Just a very minimal description, because there really is not much of an interaction. Light just goes right through water. But if you looked at this transmission matrix for zinc oxide, you're looking at 65,000 numbers that they had to plug into this matrix to make it work. So it was a lot of detail that they had to get in order to get this to work. But basically, once you have this matrix, then the hard work is essentially done. Then you could take the light, you could manipulate the light based on the matrix so that when it goes through the material and scatters all around in really complicated ways throughout the material and comes out the other end, you can make that light focus onto an object or whatever you want to see on the other side. So basically, you're prepping the light. It's kind of like you're pre-scattering the light so that when it goes through the material, it acts like a lens to focus the light so that when it comes out of the material, It's focusing the where you want it to go. That's kind of what's happening.
Why?
Well, there's plenty of potential applications from looking through biological tissue, creating nano lenses, because it's extremely difficult to make these little nano lenses for these nano devices that need them. These little optical elements are very difficult to make. Imagine making a lens that's efficient, but you can't even see it. It's so tiny. But remember, the light coming out of the back of these materials, and not all material, only certain materials will light actually even get through, even if it's only, you know, a tiny amount of photons. So you're not going to get a high-res picture coming through whatever it is you're looking through, whatever opaque material. It's not going to be some HD image. It's going to be it could be pretty fuzzy, but you can pretty much get an idea of what's going on. But what they did, the interesting thing they did is they reversed the experiment. You could take light coming out of a material, put it through your transmission matrix, and figure out what's on the other side. So that's really the best way to use it. Now, before you try to steal this device to look through the girl's dorm room, it's good. According to physicist Allard Mosk at the University in Amsterdam, he said that it's a million times more difficult to look through a 4-inch wall than what they're looking through. Yeah, obviously, 4 inches is a hell of a lot thicker than what they were looking through. So he says it's extremely difficult, and he says that it will probably be impossible to look through something like that because it's a million times more difficult. It seems a little bit pessimistic to me, assuming that the limitations on computer power alone. I would hesitate to say probably never. Who knows, 10, 20, 30 years, the processing power we'll have at our fingertips.
All right, so in essence, they're using an algorithm to unscramble or counteract the diffraction of the light as it's passing through an object.
The scattering of the light.
Got it.
Absolutely.
To me, it sounds like what the limiting factor is the thickness, because this is a very thin material that they did it to, right? Does it get like exponentially more difficult as you make it thicker? Is it going to be one of those problems that, you know, they're never going to be able to get it through anything significant?
Just by going from what these guys were saying, comparing 80 millionths of a millimeter to 4 inches is a million times the difficulty. So
yeah.
A million times. But I don't know, is that just pure processing power? I mean, if you have a supercomputer, will it go – I'm sure it'll go a little faster, but I don't know what other things it might depend on.
But remember, all problems are
right.
Amenable to pure number-crunching processing power. You know, those mathematical problems that just – but then maybe quantum computers will solve it. Who knows?
Bob, there's a huge difference between 2 inches and 6 inches. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I got you, Jay. But but a lot of people were saying, though, that if it all depends on the quality of your transmission matrix. If your matrix is really, really good, then the image you get will be better and better, and presumably you can go deeper and deeper. So who knows?
Jay, tell us why kids who are being homeschooled don't believe in evolution.
Well, the long and the short of it is that they found that a lot of these homeschooled books or sets of books that are being sold are very pro-creation and not pro-evolution. But let me give you a few stats first so we're all on the same page about the money and numbers of people involved and everything. And I believe this is all based in the United States. So it's an annual billion-dollar industry, which is a huge industry. In 2003, 2.2% of all students, that's about 1.09 million in the U.S., were homeschooled. And of those children that were homeschooled, the majority of the families were considered Christian-based or evangelical Christians. And the majority of these homeschooled books are just basically procreation and very much, and some of them were openly talking against evolution.
Yeah.
So the trend is that as more and more people each year homeschool their children, which the trend is going in that direction, there's a very limited number of companies out there producing homeschool material that isn't overly Christian or evangelical Christian based.
Yeah, because they're going to cater to the majority.
The initial homeschool audience were evangelical Christians, and then there's their base. So now they're just feeding what they consider to be their base and not possibly a lot of other people who don't want to teach their children that or don't want to get, you know, to start a curriculum of books based on that. So there was one company mentioned in the article that one consumer thought was definitely science-based, which is good. But it just seems like the vast majority of the books out there, from what I've been reading, are all suffering from this problem.
Yeah, my question is, I mean, if you homeschool your kid, how are they assessed? How is the quality of their education assessed? Is it just they have to go through a pre-approved program, or do they have to take some kind of equivalency testing? And if they're going through a pre-approved program, are these creation-based science programs approved? And who's in charge of that process?
I really don't know. I don't know. Like, can you get a GED from being homeschooled? I would think you can.
Well, yeah, but I think in order to get a GED, and you just need to complete certain tests, right?
That's an equivalency. That's just saying you have to purely pass tests. Homeschooling is different.
But generally, you know, there's no... You can be taught any crap during homeschooling, but so long as you get the basic points that are going to get you to pass a test to get your GED, then you'll be fine.
Yeah.
So so you get the evolution question wrong, you can still get your degree.
Yeah, I mean, the regulations are all state by state, so there's no one answer, you know, in this country. So Connecticut has its own laws for what you have to do in order to satisfy the criteria for saying you're homeschooling your kids. But you have to go into every state's laws and look at the details.
What I was also surprised to read, though, was that the quality of the overall education wasn't significantly less than a public school. And I think part of the reason why is that the children who are homeschooled are getting a little bit more or significantly more amount of attention directed solely at them. You know, you're not in a room of 10 or 30 or more kids. You know, it could be you with one or two other kids or just, you know, teacher-student relationship like that one-on-one. And that is significant. That makes a big difference.
Well, and how is that judged? You know, how is the quality of the education being judged in that instance?
Well, you know, there are lots of relevant statistics on homeschooling that will help us assess this. First of all, homeschoolers are using a lot of internet resources, about 12%. A lot of them are using distance learning resources, and a lot of them are using the public library, around 78%. Only about half are using these dedicated homeschooling materials that we're talking about, but that's still a lot. In terms of how do we know what the quality is, that's tricky. Most states don't require any formal testing. Some do, but most do not. Therefore, testing is voluntary, or only those homeschooled students who are trying to get into college will do the voluntary testing. If you look at standardized tests, homeschooled children tend to do better than the average for public school. Sometimes, typically in like the 79th percentile for some standardized tests, for example. However, and we get into the same problem when we compare the United States with some other countries, the same kind of bias creeps in. With the statistics for public schools in the United States are for mandatory testing, so everyone gets tested. You know, the full spectrum of intelligence and achievement in students. But with homeschooled kids, if it's voluntary, only the kids who are doing well are going to test and report it. So you get a self-selected and biased sample. And that alone is probably enough to explain the differences in statistics. So the bottom line is we don't really know. Unless we systematically and mandatorily tested homeschoolers in the same way that public school kids are being tested, we really don't have any basis for a direct comparison. The law, so again, it's state by state, but just to give you an example, like in Connecticut, there are guidelines for homeschoolers, but they don't really have the force of law, and no one's really ever been challenged. But also, there is the Connecticut Religious Liberty Laws, which are in the Connecticut Constitution, and also, you know, public acts based upon that. So essentially, parents invoke this, you know, the religious liberty laws to say that they have the right to homeschool their kids for whatever reason they choose, and they can teach them whatever they want, right? And then there are guidelines, but apparently those guidelines don't have the force of law. So it seems like a pretty loose system to me.
Yeah, I don't think there should be a law that says your kids have to be educated in the public school system. you know, I just think...
Well, there isn't. Yeah, I don't think anyone thinks that there should be.
Okay, good. But I agree with what Rebecca is saying, you know, her concern about the regulation as far as the quality and how do you test these kids and how do we do, you know, how do we know that they're getting a decent education? I think every child, of course, deserves a very good education. But, you know, how do you do that? You know, how much taxpayer money would it cost above and beyond what the school system's already cost? And schools are incredibly expensive. Well, Kansas is – did you read the article about Kansas having to significantly reduce the size of their schools, and they're firing a lot of teachers and everything because they basically are going bankrupt?
Oh, is that right?
Well, a lot of people are moving out of the school district because of all the controversy that's going on.
Oh, I see.
Who isn't going bankrupt these days?
That's interesting. So that's another way in which the creationism controversy could be hurting public school education, at least for certain local regions, because it's driving people out of the taxpayer base, you know, for those educational systems. Well, let's go on to the next item. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about the fact that we finally can get that jetpack that we've been promised all these years.
Ooh.
We finally can get that jetpack we've been promised all those years.
Yes.
That's all. Oh.
A little bit more detail would be nice.
Details.
Details. Okay. Well, it is very exciting because, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but it is 2010, which is, I think most of us had this date set as the date where we would get our jetpacks. So, good news. They're on their way. There's a company that has designed a super fan pack. It's basically, you know, it looks quite a bit like the jetpack of our dreams where it straps to your... Oh, don't get excited, first of all. Second of all, you know we can't use that word anymore now that we're an international show. it'll be bleeped in other countries. Yes, a super fan pack straps to your back, and you have two controls that you can operate with your hands. And there are two jet engine looking turbine fans on the back.
But it's not. There are no jet engines on this.
It looks like a jet engine. That's what I mean.
Yeah. But they're not jet engines, and they're not rockets.
Jet engines.
Yeah, it's not actually a jetpack. But
it's more like a personal helicopter.
They're fans. And you know, there are videos of it in action, and it's looking pretty stable. You can it runs on premium gas, and so you know you can fill up at your local station, I guess. And it can go up to 60 miles per hour with an 8,000-foot ceiling, and there's no pilot license. You don't need a pilot license.
Yeah. The company. Right. The company. If you buy one of these from the manufacturer, that they make you go through a training period before they'll give you the machine.
Right. Yeah. They don't just hand these out to rich wackos and tell them good luck. It would be very bad PR.
Yeah,
the first billionaire who tumbles from the sky.
It is pretty badass,
but
though.
I mean, it also comes with it comes with a low altitude ballistic parachute.
Yes.
Just in case everything goes terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah.
Which makes me think that some of the first people to use this are going to be what do they call those guys?
Early adopters?
No.
Test pilots?
Base jumpers.
Yeah.
Base jumpers looking for a cheap thrill. You just rock it up 8,000 feet and then drop.
Yeah, and Rebecca, the device only weighs about, what, 250 pounds, they said?
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it's not amazingly heavy either, which I found interesting. I thought it would be a lot heavier than that. But
well, you would think they would want to make it as light as possible.
Yeah, but even still, it just looks like it's a lot heavier than 250 pounds. Yeah. I mean, that's only, you know.
Well, it's very sleek. It looks like it was designed by Apple.
Yeah,
it's a very cool looking futuristic machine, and I think the best part of it though is that they're hoping to make 500 jetpacks a year and get them in at $75,000 each. That's nothing, man. We, in fact, I think we can raise that amount And, you know, we have, I think we have a link on our website that where people can donate for us to go to Australia. So I'm thinking we put up another link where people can donate to get the SGU a jetpack.
Yeah.
Is that why you emailed me that? You wanted me to put that link on the website today?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I was serious,
Jay. I thought you were kidding.
No, then we get jetpack into our live event.
How cool would that be?
That's an entrance.
I vote that Rebecca gets to go first.
Yeah. Well, it's my idea, so yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not strapping that thing to my back and being a test pilot for that company.
No, I'll try it out first. And the company is, I think, a New Zealand-based company, or at least the owner is. And so, you know, that means that if we can work this out by the time we visit Australia in November – I mean, we could just swing on over and pick it up there.
Can we fly it home?
Yeah. Maybe.
We could work out
maybe
some
not.
In-flight refueling. That could work. But one key question, though, one of the most key questions, I think, is, what, Rebecca, what's the range? I mean, how many miles, how much time can you spend in the air? To me, that's one of the key obstacles that they
– Well, right now, apparently, it's 30 miles. Which I think is decent. I mean, that'll get you to the grocery store and back. That'll get you to work.
Yeah, but where are you going to put your groceries?
Well, in your fanny pack.
Yeah.
Maybe once they start producing a lot of them, they'll add like little extras, like a basket, you know, to put your your groceries in.
Yeah. Just to clarify, you said it's a 60 mile per hour.
Yes,
speed
60.
Limit. Yeah, 60 with a 30-mile range. That I agree with
Bob.
Yeah,
you can go half an hour.
Half an hour. That's a limiting factor right there.
Yeah, but it's a recreational thing.
But you're right, Steve, but a half hour compared to other, you know, other jetpacks is great because normally it's like 2 minutes, 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes at
I've never heard
at
of a jetpack with a 10-minute burn time.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
That might even be a lot for a regular jetpack.
I mean,
so 30 minutes is good compared to that.
That is really good. I mean, that's longer than that's like so much longer than anything else that exists. And the thing essentially does the same exact thing as a jetpack, except it's a lot safer.
And it seems like they would be able to eventually add on some more fuel capacity. Like, I don't know. It seems like maybe if you lost some weight. You could, you know, you lose 20 pounds, you bring 20 pounds more of fuel along. That would be significant, right?
And make
That's
it lighter,
true.
Lighter
That's,
materials.
That range is for like a thin person probably.
Yeah.
You know. So, I mean, clearly we have solved the stability problem. If you look at all of these applications and flying cars, et cetera, computers, algorithms, we've solved the stability problem. That's no longer the issue. The issue still remains the
fuel.
Range. Yeah. Well, the problem is when you add more fuel, you don't get a linear increase in range because now you have to carry the fuel around. So you get diminishing returns as you add more fuel. That's always been the limiting factor with flying devices that you have to carry around your own fuel with, these hovering devices, whether it's a hover car or a jetpack equivalent or whatever. So,
their audience is definitely going to be, you know, the key consumer is going to be successful jockeys. You know, they've got money, they're tiny.
That's right, or successful dwarf actors, I guess.
Peter Dinklage.
I'd like to see like 20 of them flying in unison. That would be really cool looking.
It'd be like the nerd Blue Angels.
But I agree. I think this is going to be recreational.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that this is going to cross that line from being recreational to being your commute
a mode
to work.
Of transportation.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
Well, you know, it didn't happen with the Segway, but
right.
Maybe, just maybe.
And the other thing to always think about is there a military application? You know, is this a way of rapidly deploying soldiers into a hot zone or getting them out of a hot zone, for example? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that the military is probably going to get in on this fairly quickly.
It's funny how the jetpack has become the icon of the false promise of future technology, you know?
Mm. Where's my jetpack?
Where's my jetpack?
or the flying car. They're kind of neck and neck,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah, yeah, the flying car as well.
You know what's funny, though, when you say, like, you talk about jetpacks or whatever, and when they were originally, you know, selling this to the public as what the future is going to hold and all that, up until, like, the last 5 years or so, computing power wasn't even there to make it relatively safe. You know what I mean? Like, you couldn't just strap a jetpack to somebody's back, and there'd be so many deaths if we did develop jetpack technology, say 20 years ago, because there would be no computer assist.
No, right. The computers have solved that, the safety stability problem. We need a denser fuel. That's it. We need a more energy per pound fuel. That's the limitation right now.
Yeah, isn't it too bad that we just don't have like a, you know, something the size of a brick that just has an enormous amount of energy, and then you just replace that when you run out of energy? Like, it's never going to be that easy.
Well, I wouldn't say never. You could have a matter-antimatter battery, basically, would probably cut it.
That would be nice, but even before that, well before that, we'll see fusion reactors. Who knows how small they could be. That's really, you know, when you start getting your energy from nuclear forces, that's where it just blows away chemical energy. It's, you know, orders of magnitude more energy dense. So that's what we're going to need to see such a huge leap in energy density. It's got to go to that. And who knows, you know, they're working on the reactors, and some of the research is looking pretty good. But eventually they might even scale it down and make it real tiny, and then we'll be set. That'd be great.
Well, in the meantime, until I get my my jetpack-like device, I'll just be playing Call of Duty at home on my Xbox.
Whatever gets you up in the morning, Jay. We are now being joined by the better late than never, Evan.
Yeah, that's me. Hi.
Yeah.
I'm not used to this Thursday night recording thing.
I know.
It's totally cramping my style.
Sometimes real life intervenes with our precious podcast. But thanks for making the effort to at least join us for part of the show.
I always love being here. Thank you.
So, Evan, tell us about Spirits in a Bottle.
A lot of our listeners sent us the link and the story behind this one, especially our friends in Australia and New Zealand, because the headline reads, "Bottled Ghosts Were Sold in a New Zealand Auction." Two glass vials said to contain the ghosts of an old man and a young girl have sold for about $2,000, New Zealand money, in an online auction in New Zealand.
How'd they get them in the bottle?
Oh, well, very easily. Magic.
Oh, okay.
200,000 page views on the Trade Me website were viewed for these particular vials. And the winning bid, of all places, the top bidder was an electronic cigarette company.
What is that?
E-cigarettes?
Oh, those stupid things? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it's like there's a promotional thing they're going to use.
Yeah, it's a promotional.
How much?
$2,000.
That's a pretty good,
New Zealand
bad.
Dollars.
It's
that's
not
about,
bad for,
what,
I mean, think about this.
Like $2 with the bottles.
Bucks here.
Evan, for the amount of time and money it took to put that cork on the top of the bottle, that's good money.
So, you know, we've come across stories similar to this before. We have, you know, grilled cheese with you know, the Virgin Mary on it, and there was the pizza pan, if I'm not mistaken, and of course the old classics like the oil stain in the bank in Florida, the tree in Hartford. So much, you know. This isn't pareidolia.
This is just made up bullcrap.
It's kind of along the same It's along the same lines, right? It's fascinating what you can get away with.
What was amusing is people saying it's not fair to trap people's spirits in a bottle. Yeah, but it's also not true. You know, is the bigger point. You know, don't worry about it.
How do they know this is an old man and a girl? I mean, who were these people, and how the spirits got in? No details whatsoever as to the total backstory as to how this all occurred.
My understanding was that spirits were supposed to be non-corporeal. So how are they contained within the glass of these vials?
There seems to be a liquid inside, so they're in some sort of...
Yeah, but liquid is still matter.
You got to build a special containment unit. You know, you slide it underneath the entity, and the doors open on top, and some sort of weird magnetic field sucks them in. It's obvious. Come on.
Now, this person, Avi Woodbury, is the person who said the ghosts that were captured and in her house by an exorcist and stored in holy water. Okay, so it's holy water. That's what's anchoring.
Wouldn't that drive them away?
And, well, it's complex. It involves a lot of math and, you know, quantum mechanics.
But this is the low-tech way, Bob, I think, of capturing the ghosts.
It must be. Okay.
Now, when asked, Mrs. Woodbury told the bidders she had experienced bizarre activity in her home, such as a jug would start boiling, apparently on the stove all by itself, and she would feel someone touching the back of her neck. There were voices in the other room, and items would go missing and then turn up in weird places.
Did you have a cat?
There is no other explanation other than ghosts in a vial.
Right.
For any of that phenomenon. Oh, and the dog was mental, according to...
Yes. Yeah. Well, dogs can smell ghosts, right?
Yes. Yes, they are. It's the sixth sense or the seventh sense or however many senses the dogs have. So there you are. That's the latest and greatest in the world of auctions that, you know, auctions for
capturing
mundane
spirits.
Mundane items based on the face.
Yes, in a bottle of holy water. Now, we have to be able to make up something that we can, that has no intrinsic value, would be very cheap, you know, in order to get, and that we can claim has some kind of supernatural or paranormal value, and then sell it for thousands of dollars. The only problem is that this pesky ethical stuff gets in the way, you know?
Yeah, I hate that stuff.
Evan, let's go on to Who's That Noisy? Can you play the noisy from last week?
I will. It's another
It's an
animal.
Elephant.
That was 2 weeks ago, Jay. You're confusing the listeners. All right. Here we go for those of you that forgot.
And what was that, eh, Evan?
There's a Sean Connery line I could say, but I'm not going to say it. Oh, did you guys have any guesses as to what that, besides elephant, which was the week before that? You guys know what animal?
Like a million people got it right, right? Everyone who lives in Canada.
Canada and the West, because that was a bull elk.
Yeah.
It was a male elk making all kinds of interesting noises. Or, you know, I guess it's normal day-to-day noises, because so many people knew exactly what that was.
Yeah.
So, you know, one
who
week,
got it first?
Well, although some people got it right on the message board, it was, in fact, an email this time.
Ooh, excellent.
From Anthropologist, last name Underground. Anthropologist Underground.
Cool.
That is cool. It was the first to guess correctly, so... Well done. Thanks for playing.
Excellent. What do you got for this week, Evan?
This week, we have one of my favorite animals, a human being.
But the key point is mystery. That's one of the things that makes science so special, I think, is that scientists love mysteries. They love not knowing. That's a key part of science.
Thanks, Evan.
No problem. Good luck, everyone.
Well, let's answer a couple of your questions and emails. The first question comes from Stuart Goldman. Stuart writes, been a listener for quite a while, but haven't been compelled to write before. Today, however, I'm actually listening while at the computer as opposed to listening to the podcast in the car, when I always forget what I could have commented about. Anyway, regarding your commentary about the Chilean earthquake, a magnitude 8.8 quake is sufficient. Adding on the Richter scale, as someone did, is not correct anymore, as geologists haven't used it for years. Thanks for a continually enjoyable show. So, Jay, he's totally calling you out on your egregious scientific error.
I can't believe you did that, Jay.
All right, first I want to apologize. Like, I did not read that in the article. I added that on my own, and I totally fell prey to exactly what the emailer said. Like, people just add that in, because we're hardwired at this point, it seems, to just add that in at the end whenever we're talking about earthquakes. It really is... something, a mistake that many, many people make, and a lot of people, a lot of news reporters make that. So I am sorry, but I did read the information that he sent, and it was actually really interesting. The bottom line is that the two scientists that came up with the Richter scale was two men, one guy named Richter, one guy named Gutenberg, and his last name was actually Richter scale. So they developed this. I couldn't actually find the year that the term was coined or when they came out with it. They came up with this to rate earthquakes in California. And I guess there's a significant difference between earthquakes, like the frequency of the earthquake.
Jay, the Richter scale was developed in 1935.
Thank you, Steve. You hear that, people? The Richter scale was invented or discovered
developed.
Or produced or came up with, developed in 1935.
I thought it was discovered.
It was written on a piece of paper, and the guy's, oh, look at here.
The Native Americans discovered before that.
So basically, as more and more stations across the planet were created that were listening, I guess they started to realize that the way that the Richter scale measures the earthquakes wasn't suitable for all over the world. So there was a few other ways that they measure it. One of them is called the body wave magnitude, and that's MB. And the other one was a surface wave magnitude, and that's MS. So basically all three of these in their own right are not poor judges of the magnitude, but the Richter scale just didn't cut it for like all of the
really?
Earthquakes that were going on. Yeah.
So it's just a combined scale now, or does it just call it a magnitude, but it's not really on any one specific scale, or it's the seismic scale, I guess.
Well, it's known as the moment magnitude, okay. MW. That was developed in 1979, and I was really surprised to hear how long ago it was developed. That's a long time ago, and you know why are we still throwing around the term?
Wow, I did not know that. That is cool.
It's just a meme with momentum. Do any of you guys know about a magnitude 10 earthquake that occurred?
No, it's impossible.
No, I
there's no fault. There's no faults that are long enough to produce a magnitude 10 quake.
It's never been recorded by humans. What's the biggest earthquake?
It has
9.5.
Been recorded by puppies.
9.5.
And they estimated the magnitude of the asteroid impact at the Yucatan Peninsula.
Ooh.
What do you think?
As what?
What do you think?
I guess it had to be more than 10.
Yeah, it's more than 10.
That's possible.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. I'm scary to guess what, like 30? Well,
no, for Gajay, it's logarithmic, dude. 30 would rip apart the planet, I suspect.
13. Yeah. 13.
That sounds right.
Right, but it's a logarithmic scale. So 9 is 10 times as strong as 8. 10 is 10 times as strong as 9. So 13 would be 1,000 times stronger than the theoretical upper limit of earthquake magnitudes. You know,
I don't like the way that these scales work. They're really counterintuitive. Like, you just can't get a real feel for what the difference is between a 5 and a 6, say.
It's 10
times.
I know that's
order of magnitude.
You know, Mr. Smarty Pants over here. All I'm saying is, like, it doesn't feel like it's, you know, it's not easy to grasp.
Yeah, I think we're probably more intuitively understand linear scales, but it just can't work with earthquakes. I mean, you have such a wide range of strength. I mean, you'd have to call it, you know, a billion or something.
Right, the range would go from a 1 magnitude to, this was a 10,000 magnitude. It's just even more. It's just, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around it even more, I would say. Maybe. I don't know. I like the way it is.
I like orders
but
of magnitude.
But does that mean that, like, the difference between a 5 and a 6 and a 6 and a 7, like, you know, if you're in one of those earthquakes, how much more are you being shaken up? That's all I care
well,
about.
Well, I'll tell you, to give you some idea. So a 4 to 4.9 is noticeable shaking of indoor items, rattling noises, significant damage, unlikely. Less than that, you generally not – like 2 to 2.9, you wouldn't even feel it. 3 to 3.9, you'd barely feel it. 4 is shaking. In the 5s, causes major damage. And it goes up from there to like a great earthquake anywhere between – like the ones in Chile, 8 to 8.9 – causes serious damage for several hundred miles, you know.
Can you stand up when something that strong is happening, or are you just totally knocked
over? Depends on how good your balance is, I guess.
That's got to be so scary. Could you imagine? That's crazy.
Let's go on to the next question. This one comes from Noya Chongwa from Australia. We asked for some follow-up for the raining fish story, and they write, "Hey guys, you are right to be skeptical of our local rag, the North Territory News. It is crap pretending to be a newspaper. It makes up a lot of stories, including about UFOs, Bigfoot's feet, that sort of thing. It's absolutely rubbish, and no one should believe a single thing they print. Even if it's not a woo story, they just make stuff up. I tend to agree with Dr. Naval about fish being splattered if they fall out of the sky. Also, I don't imagine there could have been a water spout at Lajamanu, pronounced Lajamanu, by the way. As it's kind of in the desert. We've had water spouts in the harbor here in Darwin, but I don't think there's a big enough body of water down there, and it's a long way from Darwin, about 800 kilometers. So it wouldn't have come from here bearing fish, even time-traveling fish. Mm-hmm. Besides which, are the forces that form water spouts strong enough to pick up fish? That was my question. I didn't think they were like tornadoes, even though they look a bit like them. They'd also have to be damned high up to be frozen. It's bloody hot here at the moment, and that particular rain was a bit like a lukewarm torrential downpour. I don't think that you'll be able to get anyone to go there from Sydney. It's truly in the outback. It would take a few days to drive there. It's a day to drive from Darwin, and I think you'd probably need a four-wheel drive to get there. The other thing is it's highly possible that we have fish in the Northern Territory that kind of come out in the rain. In Darwin, we have frogs that bury themselves during the dry season, and that came out with the first rains. I'd assume that a lot of freshwater fish in Australia would have adapted for our very dry conditions.
It's very interesting that some of the fish have adapted to the dry environment so much that they just kind of like hibernate underneath the ground, and then when it gets really wet, they just kind of come out. All of a sudden, you have all these. Imagine you walk outside and you see a whole bunch of fish on the ground. I mean, what would you think? That they just fell there, right? You wouldn't think they dug up from the ground.
Well, unless you lived there, though, and saw that sort of thing all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how often that would be. Yeah.
No, I think it's still a rare event when it happens, like maybe every 10 years or something.
Yeah.
My question was, has anyone seen fish clogging up the gutters of their house, on the roof of their house?
Yeah,
not
right,
on the ground. And I tried and tried and I couldn't find any pictures of that. I asked, I can't remember if it was this email or we had another email from the region, and he said it's like the third world there. I mean, people really don't have, wouldn't be expected to have cell phones with cameras. So the idea we're not seeing any video or pictures is not surprising. Another emailer sort of endorsed the notion that maybe a water spout could pick up small fish and move it 100 yards or so, but not miles, not hundreds of miles. Yeah, so,
that makes sense.
And many of our listeners pointed out the fact that Brian Dunning covered this issue as well in Skeptoid, which I actually had listened to prior to last week's show. And I think Brian also discussed the notion that there really isn't any evidence for the water spout hypothesis, and that the flooding fish coming out of dry mud was more probable. So thanks for the feedback. I still want to see pictures of fish on a roof. Then I'll change my mind. Last question. This one comes from Jason Elric from Cape Town, South Africa. And Jason writes, space is often my favorite topic on the show. This is maybe a Bob question. We hear about the frontiers of outer space. However, I was wondering what are currently the frontiers of inner space? Or maybe, what would be the measurable frontiers of inner space? Would it be appropriate to say what's being undertaken at the LHC would be exploring this question? Maybe another angle for this question is, how small can we go right now? Yours in rational thinking, Jason Ulrich.
Hey, thanks.
All right, take it away,
thanks
Bob.
For the interesting question, Jason. I think there are many ways to answer your question. Some people would argue that the smallest practical inner space frontier is the realm of the angstrom, which is about 1/10 billionth of a meter. Imagine the thickness of a sheet of paper. That's about 1 million angstroms thick. So that's pretty darn tiny. This is the scale for atoms and the wavelength of some electromagnetic radiation. We could do some work directly at this scale, like with scanning tunneling microscopes, for example, moving atoms around to spell words. You've probably seen pictures of that. Directly manipulating matter at scale smaller than that is not yet practical. So that's one frontier you could talk about. But I think that the true frontier is smaller than that. Look at what we learned about the tiniest bits of matter. Colliders, for example, are great for this. So, Jason, your LHC suggestion is a good one. Colliders basically throw matter together and see what pops out. That's essentially what they're doing. These experiments have brought us to the frontier of particle physics, and the smallest and most fundamental components of matter, like quarks, which make up, among other things, protons and neutrons. Quarks are indivisible particles like electrons, and so they're among the few truly elementary particles. No experiment has ever shown any hint of structure inside of them, nor any way to measure their spatial extent. So I would definitely call this one of the primary frontiers of inner space, and it's just a fascinating topic. I love reading about it. And then finally, Jason, you ask how small we can go. Another way to rephrase that, I think, is how small can we think? We can think and theorize way smaller than a quark or electron. It's really fun to see what scientists are thinking about and talking about at that scale. In my opinion, the smallest theoretical frontier is at the Planck scale of space-time. I've mentioned it a couple times on the podcast. This scale is about 100 billion billion times smaller than a proton. Any structure at this scale, if it exists at all, could not be smaller than this so-called Planck length, which is the fundamental unit of length or grain allowed in space-time, kind of like the smallest pixel, if you will. Space-time breaks down into a sort of quantum foam at that scale. So you can't really – it doesn't make any sense to go any smaller.
Have you guys seen the Scale of the Universe
video? Yes, that was awesome.
The interactive thing?
That was cool.
Yeah, it's called the Interactive Scale of the Universe, and you can find it at newgrounds.com. Mm-hmm. What you could do – it's basically a slider. It's like you have a video, you have a picture, like a drawing, and it's – like you might be at the scale of the Earth, where you see the Earth, and you could slide it up and you go farther and farther and farther out, or you could slide it down and you go farther and farther and farther down. And you could actually see like how far you have to go scale down to get from like a quark to a Planck length, and it's immense. So it gives you some vague notion of the scales, the orders of magnitude that we're dealing with. We'll have a link to it.
It's a great little thing just to zoom in and out at the biggest scales and the smallest scales of the universe. And there's tons of detail. Somebody put in a lot of work, so check it out. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. I've had a couple of weeks off. Jay did it 2 weeks ago. Bob had his moment of glory last week.
But his head still hasn't come down.
Yeah, back to doing it again this week.
On.
Bob was so mad with power, I had to take it over from him again.
King.
Is everybody ready for this week?
Yep.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Item number one, a new study finds that weight-bearing exercise reduces the bone loss that usually accompanies weight loss through dieting. Item number two, a recent clinical trial finds that an oral medication is 95% effective in eliminating lice. And item number three, scientists have solved the mystery of half-male, half-female chickens, discovering that development of sexual characteristics is determined by inherent genetic differences in the cells, not by sexual hormones, as was previously believed. Bob, please go first.
Oh.
It's your punishment.
A little bit of payback.
It's everyone's punishment, actually. I'm just going to take a nap. Let me know when you're done.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. So we've got a new study. Weight-bearing exercise reduces the bone loss that usually accompanies weight loss through dieting. See, I was not apparently aware that you lost bone through dieting. I guess if you don't get not getting enough calcium, you could lose some bone. Well, yeah, that makes sense. That weight bearing exercise will reduce bone loss from whatever the source is. I would think it could reduce that. Let's see. So we've got an oral medication that's 95% effective. Yeah, well, I could see – I mean, things you ingest kind of after a period of time. I mean, you could test your hair. You know those quacky places that will take your hair and they'll be able to tell you, you know, about your diet and all these wonderful things about you. I mean, your hair can show certain things about what drugs and a little bit about your diet, although there's a big delay, obviously. Kind of feasible, plausible. The half male, half female chickens. Man, I wasn't even aware of those things. I wasn't even aware that was like a problem of chickens being born half male, half female.
Don't you love when people solve problems you didn't know existed?
Yeah, right.
Yes.
So for me, it's between the first two. I'll say the weight bearing one is fiction. It's just too obvious.
Okay, Jay.
So, Steve, what you're saying here is when you lose weight, there is inherent bone loss.
Apparently.
And if you exercise, which typically increases bone density, it doesn't help prevent it during massive weight loss.
No.
And it does help prevent it.
Oh, you're saying it does help prevent it.
It reduces the bone loss that would otherwise usually accompany weight loss.
Yeah, it doesn't. Overall, I thought exercising increases bone density. Especially weight-bearing exercise. And then, let's say you're losing weight while you're exercising. Isn't that just what happens when you exercise? Like you're typically... number two, a recent clinical trial finds that oral medication is 95% effective in eliminating lice. Is this a new drug, Steve?
Does it matter?
Okay. Well, I mean, what do you want me to say about this?
Is
great.
It true
somebody
or
came,
false?
Somebody came up... good. Somebody came up with a way to 95% effectively get rid of lice. Thank you. And scientists have solved the mystery of half male, half female chickens. There was a mystery? I'll tell you what. I agree with Bob.
Are you taking that route, are you?
Well, what do you mean?
Okay. Evan?
What do you mean?
I'm going to go in reverse order. The mystery of the half male, half female chickens. Now, before we go all half cocked on this,
Jesus,
oh my!
I was wondering who was going to come up with that first.
When is this day going to be over?
Day
just keeps getting worse.
It does.
It's the development of sexual characteristics determined by inherent genetic difference in the cells, not by sexual hormones. I wonder if it's because it's a bird and not a mammal. That it's the reason why it goes that way. But I don't know for sure. The second one was the oral medication, 95% effective in eliminating lice. I think that would be nice, yet I think it would be almost too effective. I mean, this would be a big cure. I mean, 95% effective, and that's huge.
Evan, GWD, baby. Go with Bob.
And then the weight-bearing exercise.
Because Bob seems so sure of himself.
I didn't know that I didn't know you had bone loss when you just
yeah you didn't know there were half male half female chickens either.
We've learned so much today.
A lot of this stuff. Well, I'll go against the grain, and I'll say the 95% effective in eliminating lice.
Rebecca,
is fiction. How's that?
Okay,
hurry up.
GWB.
I hate you all right now.
Were you asleep over there?
I don't really know if there's new oral medication for lice, but I hope there is, just because I remember as a little girl, I had lice. I had a huge, thick mess of hair.
Oh, no.
And
oh, nasty.
I borrowed someone's hat or something in the first grade. And I had to endure hours and hours of terrible pain as my mom combed through the tangled mess of my thick hair.
With a fine-toothed comb?
Yeah. With the horrible, smelly, rich shampoo thing.
Yeah.
It's terrible. So, yeah, I'm gonna say that's science.
Like a wet dog.
Just out of pure hope. And half-male, half-female chickens, that makes sense. I was aware that bone loss comes from dieting. That does happen, although normally not to the extent that people really need to worry about it. And I've always heard that the way to combat it is just by taking calcium supplements and whatnot. Weight-bearing exercise wouldn't bulk up your bones. It would bulk up your muscles. So I don't think that would necessarily help. So I'm going to go with Bob.
Okay.
GWB.
So you all agree.
And to a lesser extent,
scientists have solved the mystery of half-male, half-female chickens, discovering that development of sexual characteristics is determined by inherent genetic difference in the cells, not by sexual hormones, as was previously believed.
Obviously.
Yeah. And that one is science.
Yay.
Science. Now, the key here is the reason why this was a mystery is because if you assume that the previous model, which is still like the model for mammals, and it's not clear if this is now the exception for birds or what the implications are for other species, other orders and whatnot, that the genetics determine partly what the hormonal environment of the womb is, but then it's the hormones that determine the secondary sexual characteristics, right? So if each cell is simply responding to the sexual hormones, why would you have a chicken that's male on the left side and female on the right side? That was the mystery.
Yeah.
Oh, so it was split down the middle.
Yeah, split down the middle. What they found was that each cell develops into male or female, not based upon the hormonal environment, but based upon its own intrinsic genetics, whether it has the male or the female sex chromosomes. So that solves the mystery. You know, if you have sometimes you get that where you can have an animal that is like a fusion of two individuals or just has different genetics on one part versus the other. So that part that developed from the male you know, cells will develop male, and those from the female would develop female, even though they're all in the same hormonal environment, right? So that was the mystery, and that was the solution. So very interesting. So let's go. I guess I'll work my way backwards. A recent clinical trial finds that oral medication is 95% effective in eliminating lice. Evan, you think that one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks that one is science, and that one is science.
Yay!
Oh. Sorry, Evan. Very brave for going against the grain, but that is.
Yeah, well, you know.
This isn't off-the-shelf medication, a medication that has already been out there, not a new medication. The medication is ivermectin, a known toxin for invertebrates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's, you know, why they tested it. It is interesting that an oral medication would treat what's essentially a topical disease. But this medication actually has been on the market already as a treatment for scabies, although that's sort of in the skin, under the skin, not necessarily on top of the skin.
Don't you catch that from kissing young girls in school?
No, that's cooties.
Okay.
This is in the study, they followed 398 individuals with the treatment and 414 controls, and they found that 95% of the treated individuals were lice-free in 2 weeks after just two treatments, just two, you know, taking two doses of oral medication.
Wow.
And that, but in the control group, 85% were lice-free. So I don't know if they were also treating themselves in other ways. That seems like a high response rate in the control group.
Yeah.
But there was a statistically significant difference. So it may, you know, prove to be an adjunctive therapy for the treatment of lice. I don't think it's going to revolutionize lice treatment.
Has it worked, though, Steve? I mean, you're taking oral medication for a topical problem. Is it have to do with...
I guess enough of it gets secreted in the skin, you know, that it has an effect.
Okay.
Here it goes. It blocks neurotransmitters in the brains of invertebrates. So the lice get stupid.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, most treatments are topical lotions and shampoos and mayonnaise, what have you, to smother the lice. Two girls had lice a few years ago. That was a terrible summer. One of them picked it up from some other kid. Again, I think from just like their hat or something at the summer camp. And that was it, man. That was weeks of picking nits and treating the hair. And, oh, it was horrible.
So gross.
But since then, I did read that, I don't know if we talked about this on the show, but there was a study that showed that you could put people's heads in a hair dryer at a certain temperature, and that will kill all the lice. Just
wow,
heat.
Wow.
Just with heat. Just like 20 minutes at a certain temperature that is tolerable, and it wipes out the lice. So
it also like causes brain death.
Yeah, you got to go to like a beauty parlor type.
Remember those? Remember?
Yeah.
Jay, you remember those, right?
My mom actually had one of those in her
God, remember that? Holy.
And it really did look like a weird-ass like sci-fi machine.
Or 1950s kind of thing. You know what I've always thought, though, actually, since this my run-in with lice, which I never thought I would have? Of course, the ultimate treatment is just to shave all the hair off your body, right?
Yeah, shave.
But I couldn't talk my daughters into doing that. I tried.
I can't
really
believe
wanted
you tried.
To shave them bald.
You're a terrible dad.
It was the summer. It would have come back by school.
G.I. Jane, Sinead O'Connor. There's plenty of
chicks. That chick from Star Trek, the motion picture.
Oh, forget about it.
It was a Delton,
right? But here's the thing. Imagine if everyone in the world agreed to shave at the same time. We could eradicate lice once and for good.
Imagine if everybody in the world decided to get vaccinated at the same time.
You're saying it can't live anywhere else?
why?
That doesn't seem plausible.
You're going to convince the entire world to do something.
De-louse the world. That's a gift we can give to our grandchildren.
Steve, do you really want that to be your legacy?
De-louse the world.
De-louse the world.
Who was this guy, Steve Novella?
Well, De-louse.
We could have louse. Louse.
He hates louse.
We could do a fundraiser. Louse Aid.
And lice suck.
Actually, Lice Aid would be funnier.
Lice Aid. All right, well, let's go on to number one. A new study finds that weight-bearing exercise reduces the bone loss that usually accompanies weight loss through dieting, and that is fiction.
Yeah.
However, you do lose bone mass when you lose weight.
Well, you're probably, restricting calcium intake, and that's probably one of the main reasons, no?
No. It is because that when you're losing weight, the rate of bone turnover goes up. And while it's turning over more quickly, there's less bone mass at any given time. So you do lose bone mass because of the increased turnover.
Does that make you more susceptible to things?
Well, if you're on the edge, and you know, if you're like 60 or something, and you have osteopenia or osteoporosis, and you lose a little bit more bone mass from dieting or weight loss, then you imagine like a 70-year-old woman who gets sick and loses some weight, and then her bones were kind of on the edge to begin with. It could be a problem. And Rebecca, weight bearing exercise does increase bone mass. It's actually extremely. In fact, just taking calcium doesn't do it. You have to take calcium and exercise.
Yeah.
Ah.
Or you have to take vitamin D, or you got to take a medication, to really get the extra bone density, for some people. But really, you have to do weight bearing exercise. In fact, women leading up to menopause, because after menopause is when they really start to lose bone mass.
That's true. I have heard that.
Yeah, you really should try to bulk up your bone mass as much as possible. Men and women actually lose bone mass at similar rates when they get past 50 or 60, but men have more bone mass at their peak
to lose.
So they don't, when they're 70 or 80, they have a lot more bone mass than women do. So that it's not as much of a problem for men as for women. But if you do a lot of weight bearing exercise in your 40s and 50s to really increase your peak, that will serve you well in your golden years. So, but it's weight bearing exercise. However, so it makes sense. You do weight bearing exercise. That should ameliorate the bone loss of dieting, but they just did a study which shows that it had no effect. So it was kind of intuitive, but it actually did not help the bone loss.
See, when you lose
situation.
Bone mass, is it just the like your arms and legs, or is it other bones as well?
No, it's all over. Yeah,
your
even
penis.
Your spine.
Yep, spine, your spine.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It takes it easily. It takes it equally. From
yeah, pretty much. It's metabolic. You know, it's your bones, living tissue. And it's constantly being remade and absorbed. And it's also the main store of calcium in your body. And so it's partly a metabolic organ that controls calcium. And, of course, it's also the structure of your body, the frame. And it's absolutely living tissue. So there's lots of things that can increase the turnover rate or increase the resorption of calcium. So
bone is very cool.
Yeah. But this one happens to be fiction. I tried to get you on the fact that it was so intuitive, you should just have accepted it. But Bob went with the whole "it's too obvious" thing, which turned out to be true, unfortunately. Good job, guys. Nice effort, Evan.
Thanks.
Good job, everyone.
An A for effort for going against the grain.
Yay, effort.
Jay, please give us a quote.
Okay, I have a quote, and I could not find the person who wrote it. The quote is, "The best substitute for brains is silence."
Thank you for demonstrating that.
I was hoping you'd do that.
Well, thanks, everyone. Evan,
I have an announcement.
Yes, please announce something to
us. Thank you.
I'm announcing that I'm going to be at a conference called the International Atheist Conference in Copenhagen in June. It's June 18th to 20th, and I'm going to be there with people like A.C. Grayling, Dan Barker, P.Z. Myers, Rebecca Goldstein, Richard Wiseman, Robin Ince, Vic Stanger, and a bunch of other people.
Say hi to all of them for us.
I won't, because I pretend I don't know you when I'm with other people.
How does that work out for you?
Thank goodness we have this podcast to prove you wrong.
You can get more information at godsandpolitics.eu. So come. That'll be fun. Copenhagen. Woo. Party.
Is it Copenhagen or Copenhagen?
I prefer Hagen.
Hagen?
Because that's how I pronounce Haagen-Dazs.
Hagen. Yeah. Haagen-Dazs.
Copenhagen is a cool city.
Evan, did you want to say something?
Yeah, yes. Our friends from Skeptical, Northern California Science and Skepticism, are having a conference April 24th, 2010, at the Brower Center, Berkeley, California. Their website is skepticalcon.org. Plug them in and attend if you can. I wish I could, but I can't. I'm on the wrong
coast. And don't forget to sign up for the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. Order your T-shirt. Sign up for the dinner. It'll be a good time. Randy's going to be there. Your T-shirt.
T-shorts.
Yeah, we decided to go with T-shorts this year instead of T-shirts.
They're shorty shorts.
It's going to be a good time.
Steve, I'd like to thank you for joining us on the show this week.
Oh, you're welcome, Jay.
Yes.
No, thank you, Jay.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.